Welcome to the Procurement Show.
Hello and welcome to the Procurement Show, the show that tackles the topics we all need to think about and sets out to explore the more interesting bits of procurement. I'm Jonathan O'Brien.
And I'm Paul Philpott. I'm here to defrag Jonathan's hard disk drive this weekend. Do you remember that?
Oh,
do you remember defragging a hard drive?
You used to have to do it regularly.
It sounds like a swear word, doesn't it now?
This week we're talking about people in procurement, and specifically whether or not we should all be back in the office working together if we want to collaborate properly, and if not, why not?
The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organisations around the globe.
So to help me do this, our guest this week is a renowned supply chain and procurement specialist. She has more than 30 years' experience in consulting and operating at an executive level in procurement, both in the public and the private sector. She boasts an incredible track record for large-scale transformation programs, which have included cost optimization projects, category management, organizational design, and supplier relationship management. She's been a non-executive director and has advised boards in some big companies. Please, will you welcome to the Procurement Show, Kathleen Harmiston. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome.
Hello. I'm delighted to be here.
It's really great to have you on the Procurement Show.
Sounds like you do not have a weekend. That's quite some introduction.
It's quite a career, isn't it?
Yes.
I tried my best there. I've got some tips and hints on work-life balance now.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
We look forward to those.
And
that's
what we want to get into, because you've held senior leadership roles in lots of procurement functions. Collaboration has, well, you know, as long as I've been sort of doing procurement, it's always been the cornerstone of good procurement. But once upon a time, way back when, we all came together in a physical space. Remember those days? Then we had a pandemic, everything went remote, and it seems that now we're some way in between the two. And depending on who I speak to, depends on whether we're really back or not really back. Set the scene for us, Kathleen. When it comes to procurement collaboration, are we doing better or worse?
Collaboration for me is all about bringing people together across functionally and achieving more than what you would within a silo. Before the pandemic, yes, lots of global organizations across different time zones, different countries were doing this extremely well. And the rationale behind that was that they were supported by some sort of methodology or structure, and they were committed to meeting face-to-face at various times and optimizing the time that they had for various key milestones along the way. So they had set established methodology, they had really good goals and objectives, and they were committed to connecting with one another on a regular basis face-to-face. From a quality and quantity point of view, we're still at that same level. But if you move forward into the pandemic, what we had were individuals through a phase of sheer adversity needing to be far more creative with technology and actually redeveloping our propositions and ideas and services and offerings. The quality and the quantity of collaboration increased during the pandemic. We saw some absolutely stunning results for businesses in terms of their survival rates and achieving more creative options for consumers. That had a shelf life at the end for 18 months to 2 years. Yes, we had the technology. We had an uptick in AI as a consequence of that. And it was maybe coincidental or supportive of the pandemic. But nevertheless, we were running the two in parallel there. After about 18 months, we started to see a downturn in productivity. And this was supported by Stanford Research, where they saw about 10% reduction in productivity as a result of remote working. And we can go into what that was about and why. But after we come out of the pandemic, hybrid working seems to be more suited to collaboration. So we're still maintaining the same contact points within businesses. But I question, even with new technology, the advent of AI, more data being made available to us, is quality there as well as quantity? And I don't think we've shifted on the quality front, to be honest.
Interesting.
And this thing about quality, it's for not just the output of what you're doing, it's actually the quality of your work life as well, isn't it?
It's absolutely.
A big question mark. I mean, most of my day is spent on Zoom and team calls.
Me too.
Other video methods of embarrassment are available. Occasionally, I need to rarely meet in person. But I know that at the end of the day, I've literally have got to the stage where I've got screen overload from work.
Me too.
I'm starting to resent the screen.
Yeah.
I then go home and I have my little bit of social media, you know, scrolling through the Instagram feeds and various other platforms. So what's going in our heads? Is it okay to have this? I don't want to say I'm addicted to the screen because it's not always my choice to use the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is this all okay?
Mm.
Oh, see that. Do you know?
Favorite topics to talk about. It really is.
How to give an answer to a question without saying anything. Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, you probably are addicted.
Oh, well, thank
you. There you go. I'm Paul.
And yes.
I'm
You've got a screen addiction.
Yeah.
Well, I've got some interesting stats for you, Paul.
Okay.
In the last 20 years, our attention span has reduced from 2.5 minutes down to 47 seconds.
Wow.
Sorry, what were you saying?
You were starting from a pretty low base to start with, Evan.
Is this the
Sorry, what was that?
This is the pick on Paul episode. This is a rare one.
Right, sorry, yes. Kathleen.
Yes, sorry, you were saying.
That combined with 60% of the world on social media for at least 2.5 hours a day after their work.
Wow.
So if we take a normal work cycle being maybe 4 to 5 hours screen time, that's on a good day, by the way, then after work, we're actually scrolling and so on. There is something going on within the brain itself. What's going on inside our little heads is the brain is actually exposed to data bursts from various media sources, whether that be video, large quantities of rapid information coming in, different screens, different types of formatting and so on. And the neurons within our brain become overstimulated and overexcited to the point of overwhelm. Also, there's two parts of the brain, the frontal cortex and the amygdala, for those that are a little bit more technical. The decision-making, the emotional processing centers of the brain, the awareness and so on, becomes bathed in a chemical called dopamine. And it gives us almost a good feeling. We're short-circuiting our neurons and we're offsetting the ability to concentrate for rapid consumption of data. And as a consequence, we need more dopamine to get the same results.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Recently, they were doing brain scans on people who were doing gaming, you know, social media and gaming. And the MRI scan showed the same level of activity in those areas of the brain that I mentioned before than that of cocaine addicts. So we are addicted.
That's incredible.
David Levy coined this phrase in 2011 called popcorn brain.
Yeah.
And what we're doing, we're in little bursts of dopamine happening across our brains for several hours at a time. And we're not aware of these automatic responses that are happening. I don't know whether you've actually seen this in the workplace, but I've seen a lot of anxiety, depression, foggy brain, tired eyes, a reduction in empathy, and actually an increase in aggression. Mm. And the reason for the aggression, by the way, apparently the brain, if overloaded and overexcited, needs aggression to actually reset itself.
Mm.
So that's probably why you're seeing a little bit more grumpiness through remote working and so on.
I can definitely say that from personal experience, I can relate to the anxiety aspect.
Yeah,
and
me too.
For some reason, and this didn't happen, BC, before COVID, in that, I don't know about you, Jonathan, and I don't know about you, Kathleen, but your schedule is being driven by the diary matrix on Outlook.
Yeah.
There is no 20 minutes, half an hour travel between that meeting and the other meeting, or even the ability to get from floor one to floor 35.
I make things up and put them in.
We've got clock starts. My life is a clock start. 1 hour, 1 hour, 1 hour, half an hour, and there's nothing else.
Yeah, and people will put stuff in my schedule as well, which is why I make stuff up and like block time out and things like that. It's really interesting when we bring this back to the workplace, we're seeing this change in the workplace. And at some point, we've got to try and figure out, should we be carrying on to work remotely or should we all be in the office? So let's bring this back to procurement, because Kathleen, you've got huge experience in procurement at a very senior level. What are the leaders in procurement doing right now? What are they thinking? What do they want? Do they want to get everybody back in the office, or are they pushing for some sort of remote or somewhere between the two?
I think it's somewhere between the two from my sampling that I've done. I refer back to a Microsoft Work Trend analysis that was done just recently. 82% of leaders wanted their staff back in the workplace full time. But 72% of employees needed a better reason to come back into the workplace. The strapline that's being floated around at the moment is work is what we do. It's not a place that we go to. When you look into the survey a little bit more, you see that people are really wanting to go back to a meaningful environment to work in that is productive and that will help build bonds and create more collaboration rather than just a place to commute to and be irritated by. Because there's too much stimulation, too much noise, not enough time with their work colleagues and so on. So I believe leaders in the procurement space are happy to modulate around a hybrid model, so long as there are good guidelines and good boundaries set. If we can provide great spaces, set clear goals, for example, output-based approaches to working and trust and decentralize the decision-making in our teams, give people the empowerment to make the decisions and work a flexible model, we're going to get more results. I think procurement is heading towards hybrid rather than fully.
And that's really good to know. And it's interesting what you just said then, that the work is the thing that we do, not the place we go. Because here in the UK, just recently, the UK government has said to all its civil servants, all the public sector workers, you've got to be back in the office for 60% of your time, which feels like that's not focused on the work is the thing you do, but it's the place you go. And of course, during COVID, a lot of public sector in the UK recruited up and recruited people to work remotely, especially in some of the data science applications. And now all those people are 200 miles away from their nearest office.
Yes.
And everybody's going. Crazy, crazy thing.
It makes sense, does it?
No.
And because we're dealing with very intelligent people here that have a sense of responsibility and are structuring their days and so on, we don't need to basically micromanage them. What we do need to do is give them key highlights and key points of why they should be in on certain days. So for example, group working days, team working days, team events, particular milestones, and making sure that various individuals and stakeholders are there to actually support that effort made to go into the workplace. I think it's really developing.
The Procurement Show, exploring the more interesting bits about procurement. And now, the procurement fun fact. This edition's exciting tale of preposterous procurement, bizarre buying, or simply saucy sourcing.
Good procurement is more about change management than anything else, and when it comes to buying and implementing new technology, this can often mean driving behavioural change. A fact that the German government lost sight of a few years back when it purchased a new system to support its new road toll system for cars. The idea was to introduce a levy on all cars using German motorways, but the system would not penalise drivers who were German because they would receive a tax refund. Contracts were awarded, but it seems too soon, as the legal position had not been properly clarified. In fact, the European Court of Justice opposed the scheme, saying it discriminated against non-German European drivers. Contracts with providers were eventually terminated in 2019, only after the government lost some 53 million euros, which just goes to show that good procurement is more about good change management than anything else.
The Procurement Fun Fact. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Send us a tweet, @procurementshow, or connect with us on LinkedIn. Search for The Procurement Show.
We've talked about relationships in procurement, how the power of a good relationship can lead to so much. In my mind, relationships and good relationships is about meeting somebody one-to-one within the same environment. You can touch them, you can poke them in the eye, that kind of thing. Is it healthy to not meet in person? Does that affect our ability to make good relationships?
It really does matter because by definition, we are pack animals. We are social individuals. There are really subtle cues that we take on face-to-face interactions that we don't get through the screen. We don't get a sense of empathy or bonding or as much bonding as we would do face-to-face. And I've actually experienced myself that there's a limited sharing and having more sensitive conversations on screen as opposed to face-to-face. I've seen people become socially isolated as a consequence of working from home. They feel lonely. People are experiencing overcompensation and don't know when to stop and start their day.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't got boundaries about when to switch off their mobile and when to stop answering emails. They're becoming anxious. They're underperforming. They're feeling demotivated. And we're missing out on some of the secret sauce, really, from actually connecting and reading body language and body signals. It would be kind of productive to keep someone 100% on remote working.
Jonathan, I need to ask you a question now. Yeah. Do you think this affects our ability to make proper buying decisions, proper procurement decisions?
That's
and
interesting.
And can this be trained?
One of the key things, you know, we talk about a lot on the show around category management, supplier relationship management. And you said it just there. It's about the relationships, but in different ways. So the relationships internally with your stakeholders to get your requirements defined and be able to drive change. You know, you don't do that if you're sat on your own in a procurement function. And relationships with your key suppliers, it all comes down to the ability to do that. So the question is, can you do that effectively if you're doing that remotely? And I think back to Kathleen's answer just now, you need that magic sauce. It's a lovely phrase. You need to be able to look your supplier's key representative in the eye and have that social bond, which then gives you the relationship that you build in that. People have relationships with people. Companies don't have relationships with companies. You know, it's the people in those companies that have relationships.
Can training bridge the gap?
No, I don't think so. I think it can help you use the technology better, but we are social animals at the end of the day, and it comes down to being able to have that social connection. But I do wonder if there is a difference between introverts and extroverts. What do you think, Kathleen?
I do, and that was one of the things I had in my notes, actually, Jonathan, because the pros of remote working help decompression, and they help the introverts amongst us, who really are more happy with just sitting in a corner and doing the data analysis and actually steeling themselves to do face-to-face connections. Personality type does have something to do with it, and whether or not you're more resilient and more structured and therefore can accommodate the harshness of remote working. But interestingly, a security firm in the US, Verkada, was reported about a week ago. They're offering a 3-3-3 routine to encourage people back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more than three employees leaving work at 3 o'clock, spending $30 or more on food and drink to collaborate and to connect.
Okay.
That gives you an insight into their views on how important it is to get people, encourage people.
They are funding that. There's money being thrown at that.
And interestingly, Jonathan, McKinsey's even come out with a report recently that says it supports remote working or hybrid working to an extent. But quote unquote, there are some activities that just do need face-to-face, and that is negotiation, collaboration, creative brainstorming, team building, feedback, and decision-making.
Interesting. And it's interesting that negotiation is in there, because since BC, you know, most of our negotiation training is now done live online, instructor-led. And we can recreate those negotiations online with some body language as much as you can do on Zoom and Teams. And it is as effective as it can ever be using that technology. But it also reflects how people are negotiating, because 90% of negotiations, it seems, in the last few years have been done using over Zoom and Teams type calls rather than face-to-face. I wonder if there's a move back to face-to-face negotiations here in procurement. I want to talk about tech, actually, because we love a bit of tech on this show.
Yes.
We talk about data more than we talk about tech, I think.
We've got a lot of data about talking about data.
And we have tech that gives you data about the tech.
Yes.
If data's key to the future of procurement, how can we handle all of the data? And how does this new data-driven procurement practitioner that's semi-data scientist, how does that fit if we need to have less screen time and more physical collaboration and interaction?
Ooh, lots of questions in the overall question there. This is about understanding that we're developing an elite breed of analysts, or potentially we are. And it's a really pivotal time for procurement where we're actually given the opportunity to have more data and have more strategic analysis as a consequence. But therein lies the rub, because poor data input equals poor data output. Therefore, how do we ensure that we get good analysis and strategic content if the business is in crises, if our suppliers are not on the same level as us technologically, if our stakeholders haven't been trained in the skills that are required to engage the platforms and the software. So we're assuming that everybody is in steady state, having gone through major change cycles within their functions, and can collaborate equally. And I sense that until that is established and a new norm is created, we're going to get imbalance between the functions, and we're going to get the businesses requiring more for less because automation has arrived and assuming that training has already taken place. We all need to be in lockstep, and there might be transitioning to actually get to this steady state where we're relieved from the mundane tasks and duties, allowed to do more strategic content. It works on the premise that everyone has been upskilled into emotional intelligence and strategic decision making and analytics in a way that they haven't used before. Maybe we're assuming that we've got the right skill sets in the department when we haven't.
You've used the term automation.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
Hold yourself back.
I have to ask the question, okay? There's something inside me saying
it really quickly.
Okay, right. What about AI?
Oh.
honestly, I mean, AI, okay? Are we getting to the stage where it's not so much about getting people back into the office, but more about what we do with people at all? Mm. Are we getting towards the moment where we need to embrace the human?
It's a really good point, because this in itself is collaboration. Collaboration between man and machine. And
that's a powerful statement, actually.
Yeah. Because it's not so much now about AI replacing humans. It's about AI augmenting what humans can do and working with the machine, as opposed to the machine replacing us. Maybe it's about understanding that change is coming, and that it's pushing and encouraging procurement staff to become more strategic. And we've always wanted to do that, by the way. So we're being given the opportunity now to do that, but not to be scared about the concept of working with more advanced technology and taking up a different training opportunity and moving forward in a different way.
I would like to know where your fears are with regards to it.
Oh, yeah. I do have a lot of fears, not least of which on the basic parameters and principles on which AI is created.
Yeah.
We have to ensure that AI is very good at logical, analytical data gathering. That is what it's very good at. It is not very good at decision-making, creativity, and strategic development. There is room for both the human and AI, but as long as we're very clear that we continue to move forward with the parameters on which AI is programmed, and we keep that updated and relevant to the organizations that we work within, because otherwise we could get involved in error loops and not necessarily have staff trained enough to come back and acid test those errors, because they've moved so far away from the basic levels of data management and moved on to just strategic work, as opposed to understanding and acid testing what the data is actually saying.
I'd like to go back to what we were talking about just now, when we talked about negotiation being one of the things you need to do face to face. And it occurs to me that if I think about what we do in terms of training pre-COVID, all of our training was in the classroom and people would fly all over the world to do that. And then COVID happened and we pivoted and put everything online and replicated as much as we could how you do classroom training online and created this great new online experience.
You did it quite well.
Thank you. We had to do it, but it also set the benchmark for this is how you can collaborate online. And it's still, I would say 70% of the training that we do is live online, instructor-led.
Yeah.
It's back to 30% in the classroom where people want to come together. It seems that something's changed. So I saw a report from McKinsey that said that the pandemic meant we advanced 10 years in terms of our adoption of technology, specifically things like Team and Zoom. But I wonder if we're advancing again. Now we've had those tools and we've started play with things like how do you do interactive whiteboard stuff? How can you collaborate on those tools? Are we advancing again so we're able to have new tools, new ways of being able to do this stuff that's as inclusive and collaborative as we can get, but we're still all over the world?
Well, you're quite right in saying, you know, the adoption rates are significant. There's been a 49% adoption rate for AI in procurement. And the latest reports are saying that we've got 800 million jobs could be replaced by 2025, 2030.
Wow.
1 million employees have already undergone training in the last 3 years alone. So you're absolutely right. There is this move forward to get a balance between what we can do remotely and what AI can do for us. But just naming a few, from tendering to onboarding to integrating to compliance, design tools, contract data, ESG tracking, you name it, we've got tools to do it. But it's just making sure that we've got a balance in methodology and everyone who's in our collaboration cell is up to speed with us. And I think that's where the face-to-face really comes into its own, because we can actually have spontaneity. We can get up on a whiteboard. We can demonstrate what we're looking for and actually maximize the nuances that we wouldn't necessarily get otherwise. Do I think it should be done all physically? No, I don't. I think it's about choosing the optimal balance and sticking with what we've gained through the pandemic and locking down and loading for the next tranche of change, which is we're about to embrace, because procurement professionals across the world are getting ready to actually upskill and make sure that everyone around them comes with them.
That's really fascinating, because it also can be that with some clients, even face to face, they don't do that stuff.
It's time to Ask Jonathan.
And today's Ask Jonathan comes from Robert Lyons in Yorkshire, UK, who writes, "Dear Jonathan, I have read all your books, including the romantic ones."
Oh, thank you.
No, he didn't put the bit about the romantic ones. I just added that one in. "And I use your models and tools regularly in my work."
Oh, brilliant. Thank you.
"We have implemented many of your processes within our organization. However, if you had to pick just one tool or model that would help the most, especially when trying to convince the non-procurement people in the business, what would it be?"
Oh, what a good question. Yes, there's hundreds of tools and models, and we use them to understand different things, gain insights into different things. If I had to pick one, I think I'd go for day one analysis.
Your killer model.
Yeah, I think it is. So that's one of the mainstay models we use in category management. We use it in supply relationship management. We use it in negotiation planning.
Yeah.
And we use it to support driving sustainability.
May I ask you to quickly summarize what it is?
So day one analysis, the name is basically the tool you use on day one just to understand your position. And what you're doing is, imagine a 2x2 matrix, four-box matrix.
Yes.
You are plotting, you're considering the number of suppliers that you have available to you in the marketplace versus the number of buyers. So if you've got lots of suppliers out there that can supply stuff and there's lots of people that buy it, you know, it's a generic thing. So it's freely available. If you're not getting what you want, you can switch, you can change. All right. Imagine if you're the only people that buy it, there's lots of suppliers that can make it. Mm-hmm. So it's like tailored for you.
Yes, yes.
Right? Still lots of people that can do it. Maybe a little more difficult because, you know, there's some unique stuff there. If you want to switch suppliers, it's not quite so straightforward. Then you get to, there's only one supplier that can do this and you're the only people that buy it.
Okay, yeah.
So it's custom.
Yes.
How do you think that would work? Do you think that would be a good relationship or not?
A very strong relationship, yes. I think, but quite challenging to control.
Right, spot on, exactly right. So, you know, that's your kind of relationship where you both need each other. But think about the scenario where there is only one supplier and you buy it, but lots of other people buy it as well. Think of an example. There's only one supplier.
They're in control, aren't they? You're not in control.
Can you give an example?
I'm going to say the mobile phone brand.
Okay.
That's the fruit. They make it. You buy into their ecosystem.
Are you talking
and
Apple?
Yes, I am. Yes, yes.
For no good reason.
And you're at the whim of them.
Right, so a branded proprietary.
That's probably a good consumer example.
It
yes.
is, exactly that. So in that situation, you don't have any power. You are at the whim. So that's why it's the most powerful model, because you can just do that and you can say, right, we've got power. If we're in proprietary, how do we end up in proprietary? If we're in generic, then why are we not using the power that we have in the marketplace? And the beauty of it is, it means that when you talk to stakeholders, you show them this model and you get this aha moment. I've done this with stakeholders where the supplier was in control. The stakeholder was saying, yeah, but this supplier is good. We need them. You know, we can't upset them. And you show them the model and you realize that the supplier is just running us around a bit. And they go, oh, okay, I get it. the suppliers screw me over?
Put it bluntly.
One of those. So the answer is day one analysis. If you're not familiar with it, then it's in all the books that I've written.
Yes.
Because it is the most powerful tool to understand our position and figure out how to get out of a bad position.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your answer. And don't forget, if you want to ask a question to Jonathan, then you need to ask Jonathan. Here's how to get in touch.
Ask Jonathan. Email your question to jonathan@theprocurementshow.com. You might be part of the next show. The Procurement Show. The latest thinking, the greatest insights.
I've got to share an example with a piece of work that I did with one of the big five, and I had to go and do a face-to-face workshop with the procurement people. And Kathleen, I'm sure you'll identify with this, that if anyone's ever done any workshops with me, the thing that I love is a flip chart. And sweet. I will cling to that, and that will be the center of everything we do. Because as people are putting their thoughts up, it appears on the flip chart. You write it down exactly as they've said it, and then you can figure out how you can facilitate the training or the discussion or whatever it is. So the flip chart is the center of the universe. So one of the big five into the workshop room, no flip chart. Can I have a flip chart? Oh, we don't have flip charts. We've got rid of them. There's not a single flip chart in the building. We're all digital. And they had big screens on the wall, but no whiteboards. And they had a couple of iPads and things, but they had deliberately stripped all this stuff out to be digital and modern, but they had no tools for creativity. Mm. We found a flip chart in the basement that somebody hadn't thrown away. It had like 2.5 legs, and we got it up there and made it work. But even face-to-face, you've got companies saying, let's get rid of all those out-of-date paper things to replace it with digital, but you've lost that creativity when you do that.
You know, I couldn't agree more, because collaboration is about storytelling. It's about sharing a concept. And sometimes the screen just distorts that.
Yeah.
How do you engage and captivate? You do that through a central point, whether that be sitting around a table, sitting around a fire, or sitting around a whiteboard. It's no difference. As long as you've got a focal point, and individuals don't have the advantage of switching their screen off or becoming distracted in some way, shape, or form, which is easy to do on screen, but is less easy to do in open forum. Give me a whiteboard any day.
Yep.
I don't want to go into details because it's not right, but I'm happy to admit failure as an example.
Right.
In that a project we collaborated on together, we probably ran, I would say, a good 3 months past the expected delivery timeline.
Right.
Because we tried to do it between us remotely with
our
teams.
I know what you mean. Yep.
And then through the correct level of frustration, shall we say, you said, no, we've all got to get together. Come on, everybody. We all traveled to your HQ to once again reboot this project.
And we stood around a whiteboard.
And we stood around a whiteboard.
And we did it in half an hour.
And we did it in half an hour.
Yep, that's right. It did.
And it was all about talking over the top of each other, interrupting each other with a new idea. No, hang on. But what if you do this? Scrubbing something out, moving things around. We were very active. We were very tactile. All these things you can't do tactile.
And you got your own way.
I got my own way. Yes, you can't do hands-on with Zoom. But maybe in the future, perhaps. It does also lead me to ask about the environment, which is another thing we always like to cover on the Procurement Show, and indeed all our guests like to cover. There is an environmental impact of working physically together. When you have to go from A to B, even commuting adds to the impact of CO2. And if an organisation has net zero targets, it's only just going to make it harder to reach those targets. What should we be thinking here, and how can we strike the right balance here?
I'm going to try and put it into perspective. So fully I'm behind the carbon agenda and ESG in general. You know, we've got commitments to make. We've got to improve our supply chains. We've got to support the local communities as well as the wider environment. But the World Economic Forum has just published results to say that 50% of global CO2 emissions are from the top 8 supply chains. So we have to become relative in terms of what we can do and how we can do it. That said, if our organization has carbon targets, it's what we can do for our organization in terms of maximizing the workspace, limiting travel, recycling where we can, LED lighting, thermostat reduction, you know, taking the thermostat down by a couple of degrees. And there's all sorts of things you can do within the work environment itself. But I would say that the biggest opportunity is within tiers 1, 2, and 3 in the supply chain. Mm-hmm. And actually educating our suppliers. Now, we come back to the same old topic. How do we educate our suppliers more effectively on carbon reduction techniques? How do we audit them? How do we educate and train them? Do we do that remotely? Or again, do we come back to the McKinsey view that says there are various things that must be done on site because they're just more effective?
So we could be ineffective if we actually stop meeting with our suppliers and having those right relationships because we're too busy saving a micro amount of carbon to tackle the real big carbon impact of some of our big supply chains.
And that can only be achieved by doing it together.
Right. Brilliant.
Actually, that's my consensus as well. I think we should just carve out what we can and can't do.
We started talking about, should we come back to the office? And we ought to come back to that at some point on this podcast, I think. I've heard, because I've talked to a lot of people recently who've said we're going back in the office more. And I've heard lots of stories about staff resisting that. And Kathleen, you mentioned that earlier as well. I even know of somebody who became afraid of going back to work full time. It triggered a whole bunch of anxiety. Mm. Again, we touched on that earlier. If I'm a CPO and I've decided, look, we're going to bring people back, we're going to have more collaboration and set some ground rules about doing that. What do I do? How do I get them back?
The genie's out the bottle. So we've had the pandemic, we've indoctrinated a new way of work and we've shown that it can work. You know, remote working is effective for a short period of time or for short bursts of time. But I believe this is about us taking a new approach to leadership and empowering our people with hybrid models. So if you look at what IBM is doing, it's gearing its return to work model through outputs. It's saying you can have flexible working as long as outputs are achieved. Ford is arranging itself through a series of milestone meetings. So whatever's important, key milestone meetings, you come in and attend those in projects. Uber and Citi are dictating that it should be 2 to 3 days a week on site. And others are tiering their systems from flexible to full-time in the office and hybrid. It's about being willing to develop a culture of trust in your organization, creating output-based management and a schedule for the team to work around. What's important to the group, which meetings they should come in for, which are mandatory, allowing each team to set its own cadence and connect with its stakeholders accordingly, and set expectations and have a good work environment to connect within. That combined with telling and informing your staff about the dangers of total remote working, I think is the best thing we can do, and being open and honest about what's important in the business. A mixed bag, really.
This is also having an impact with our colleagues in property portfolio and those kind of management lines, because I've got some clients in big old Canary Wharf in London. Canary Wharf is empty.
Yes.
I think it's an unusually high percentage of floors that aren't occupied.
Yeah.
These buildings, they're a big asset.
Yeah,
you know,
they cost a lot of money.
They cost a lot of money to not run, bizarrely. So there's a bigger impact here. I want to just ask you, though, about the actual physical impact of all this, because one minute we're sat down, next minute we're in front of a screen, next minute we're moving. Are there any tips and advice that you should give us with regards to how all this screen time difference in levels of activity affects us physically?
The most important thing is to accept that change is coming. And not only is your business going through its normal change routines and cycles, but there's a new wave of change coming with the uptake of AI and learning new skills and techniques. It's about accepting that you're going to have to be a little bit more vulnerable, clearly defining what your needs are, looking after your boundaries at home and making sure you get enough downtime, enough rest, reducing the amount of screen time that you have before you go to bed, because studies show that it affects REM, deep sleep patterns. It can affect the hormone levels in your body. Actually, the inflammatory responses in your body can increase massively with a rise in cortisol levels, for example. So it's important that you stick to the boundaries and tell your manager what's important to you, and also ask for the appropriate training and education, because that's going to cause a lot of fight or flight responses and anxiety that's not controllable. It might go back to old responses that we've had from childhood patterns where we feel a little bit out of our comfort zone and don't cope with change very well. So you'll need support and guidance. You'll certainly need good boundaries and definitions of what the roles are between AI and you. And you'll need your procurement officer, your leader, to make sure that there's enough budget in there to train and educate everyone accordingly. and just have enough opportunity within the business to talk about the change and accept that there are new patterns and new exciting ways of working coming ahead. Connect with change, and like ambiguity, it's going to be easier than those that are resistant to change.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Jonathan.
But you're going to.
But I'm going to anyway, because it's fun. Kathleen's mentioned about asking for training. It seems that actually the topic of health and well-being throughout all this needs to be integrated in this procurement training. Do you do that as a trainer?
It's a really interesting question, because part of any training is about how you actually make it work. It always feels a bit sort of detached for me to say, okay, here's the technical stuff and we're going to give you some personal skills to help you be good. Whenever we've taught category management and supplier relationship management, part of that is helping people have the skills to be able to go and have difficult conversations in the business, stressful conversations, challenge procurement to say, why are you doing it like that? Those are the sorts of things that we cover and we talk about, because people need to be able to do that stuff. Kathleen, just listening to what you're saying there, it feels like we need to do that even more in terms of how can you equip yourself to take responsibility for how you're going to navigate your way through this, because it was only not so long ago that we just started walking upright, and here we are dealing with all the complexities of all this screen stuff, dopamine hits that we really want to keep going and stuff like that. I think we need new skills, and I think for me that's a bigger issue than what we do in procurement. That's a human issue around how do we better equip ourselves to cope with this world that we've created that we're ill-equipped to cope with. And I think I get to the point with, we can do stuff with what we do, but it's everyone has to do stuff as far as we can make that happen. Mm-hmm. Which brings me to my last question, because we've covered so much ground on this procurement show and I'm fascinated by it. If I asked you to sum that up and give us your three takeaways, what would they be?
Before I give you the three takeaways, just a point to make about there's so much change. I would encourage people to think about the fact that they're not a machine, but a highly effective decision maker with a machine. That's going to be helpful along the way. But my three takeaways are rate, response, and regime. So the rate change is going to be unprecedented growth and uptake of AI over the next 3 to 5 years. And grow with the machine, but you're not the machine. So that's the first one. Response, your body will automatically respond to the screen time and changes. So be aware that there are some aspects going on within your biology that you're not able to control real time. So you're going to get responses, fight, flight responses, dopamine responses, and so on. And just to be aware of setting boundaries for yourself and taking care of your health and managing electronic stress, and to ask for support and help and training. Be vulnerable and be brave with your boundaries. And then the final one is regime. There's a smorgasbord of systems out there, and we have to have clear boundaries and regimen set by leadership to say what is expected of our working philosophy in the workplace. How will hybrid working pan out in the workplace? And it's about trusting the team, allowing decentralized decision-making to take place, and getting the right governance around your people so that they'll feel like coming into work and wanting to reconnect with their peers and their colleagues.
Brilliant. Rate, response, regime. I think that's absolutely beautiful. Kathleen Harmison, thank you so much for joining us on the Procurement Show today. It's been a delight to have you on.
Absolutely,
I have learned so much, and it's made me think about things in a whole different way.
I'm gonna go and grab £30, three friends.
Can I be one of them?
Yes, of course you can. Yes.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Kathleen. Bye bye.
My pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Procurement Show. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn, search for The Procurement Show, and on Twitter, @Procurement Show. Visit us at theprocurementshow.com. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organizations around the globe. Copyright Positive Purchasing, all rights reserved. Produced by Fresh Air Studios.